Okay, so it's an exciting term this week. This term for Bina, as you know, I'm sure you got it in the emails and so on. Just before we start again, it's also thank you for those who have already RSVP'd for the function. Those who haven't, you can do it online or in the office. It's going to hopefully promises to be a really beautiful event. So I want to just to give a little bit of information and background to the series that we're doing, called Mindfulness and the Flow of Mind and Heart, which I think needs just a little bit of explanation so we can explain the topic. We've done quite a bit of stuff on mindfulness, but what I want to do with this series is take it on a bit of a different angle and a little bit further. And what I'm also going to do is in lead up to the 20 years function, I've been reading a book, this book, if you can't see it, called Practical Kabbalah by Rabbi Label Wolf, who is going to be our guest speaker for the event, as you probably would know already. He's a worldwide teacher of spirituality and a real mentor in Kabbalah and in psychology and so on and so forth. So I've been doing a bit of reading, and I sort of decided I'll take some of the concepts from his book and incorporate it into what we're going to be doing this term. In a big way, what he does is he actually goes through what we call the 10 Sfirot, which we've covered previously, the 10 powers of the soul, and give some practical application to them. And I'm going to combine the concepts of mindfulness with some of the stuff that he explains in that book, hence the topic as it comes together. So what I want to do today is have a look at the first one, Chochmah, but really what I want to try and achieve is explaining a concept of using our conscious mind to actually access the subconscious. Now that sounds very esoteric, but actually has extreme practical relevance when we understand the makeup and the breakup of the soul and how our consciousness and subconsciousness works and how our whole personality works. This becomes actually a very important concept of using the brain, using the conscious brain, the tool of the brain, to actually access that which is supra-rational, that which is higher than consciousness. Okay, so bear that in mind and come along with the journey, but we're going to have to take a bit of a few steps to get there. So what I want to first of all do is begin with a concept which we've touched upon in the past, or we've talked about in the past, and just take it a bit further. And that idea is the concept of the head and the heart. You remember once we did a series called Head, Heart, and Liver? And we talked about the whole concept of the head and the heart being the two main components of the human being and the forces, the drive forces of the human being that make us fully experience what we experience. The head being the power to think, cognition, and the heart being the emotion, the seat of feelings, both very, very important. And what we discussed is the concept which we call in mystical literature Moach Shalit al Alev, which is that the brain needs to control the heart. The makeup of a healthy person is that the way we think, the values, the process of engagement, of how we engage with consciousness and thinking and processing things properly, to understand them from an objective, mature, moral perspective, then can guide and inspire the way we respond to life experiences emotionally, and ultimately it has an inspiration and an impact on the way we behave and the way we act. Now I want to just pause there for a moment just to show you how this plays out in an interesting formula to do with the time of the year that we're in at the moment in the Jewish calendar. At the moment in the Jewish calendar, we're in a somewhat of a sad time of the year called the 3 weeks. Next week we move into something called the 9 days. We're culminating in Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, where we mourn the destruction of the two temples that stood in Jerusalem on Temple Mount. Yes, the temples did stand on Temple Mount, for anyone who needs to know. And it was long before anyone ever had any thought of the Temple Mount being used for any other experience or any other function. It's just absolutely ludicrous, the stuff you read these days about the Jewish connection to Temple Mount and Hebron and I mean, you just have to visit there and just have a look at the stones and you'll see. But the Temple Mount was actually, talking about Temple Mount actually, The Jewish connection to the Temple Mount actually goes way before the temples. The Temple Mount was where Avraham Avinu, Abraham, brought Isaac, and the whole story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah. Yaakov Avinu, patriarch Jacob, slept there on the way to Lavan, and he had the prophetic vision, the famous dream with the ladder. It was then bought. It was bought by King David. Just before the temples, the first temple was constructed, it was bought by taking funds from all the 12 Jewish tribes, and it was actually bought, purchased. By the way, just this has nothing to do with the topic, but it's just a fascinating thing that the three places in Israel which were actually purchased, not just conquered or given to us as a gift by God, but even more than that, they were actually purchased contractually, are the most contested sites. Did you know that? Hebron was bought by Abraham to bury Sarah, the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the cave of the Machpelah, under ridiculous discussion at the moment. Temple Mount was bought by King David, and Shechem was bought by the Jewish people to bury Joseph's tomb. The three most contested places in Israel are actually ours, not just by divine gift, but by contractual purchase. Very interesting side comment. But anyways, so back to the Temple Mount. So the first and second temple were built on the Temple Mount and were destroyed on Tisha B'Av, and we mourn the destruction of those temples during this time. Now the temple, when it was constructed using a formula which was similar to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle that was built in the desert when the Jewish people traveled there for 40 years, where God instructed to build a home for godliness, a home for divine revelation. And that was built with a particular model. And I want to show you the model, because actually the model, this is what sort of the temple would look like, but the layout of the temple was this. And I want to just show it to you because it creates the formula we're actually talking about. So it's a good image to have in mind when we're talking about this formula of how our head influences the heart and then the feelings inspire action. And if you look at the layout of the Mishkan, that top part there is the part that had a ceiling, it had a roof, and that was divided into two rooms. That small room at the top was called the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. That was the holiest spot in the temple. That's where the Aron, the Ark, was kept. Right. The next larger area of that room was called the Kodesh. It was the holy place where there were three primary vessels: the table, a small golden altar, and the candelabra, the menorah. And then in the courtyard, which was the majority of the space of the temple, was where they kept the Mizbeach, the altar, and sacrifices were brought there, and all the rituals and services of the temple took place in the courtyard with no roof. It was an outside area. And the mystics explain that this actually is not just a structure, or not just a design that God wanted us to do, but actually carries with it a very important message, and it carries within it the formula of the human personality. And the way it works is like this, that our source, our origin, our compass is the holiest part of who we are, and that's where the Aron was kept, the Ark, and that Ark is a symbol of learning, a symbol of intellect, a symbol of understanding. That's the head. In other words, that's what should guide us. Rationality, being rational, having values, having a moral compass, engaging in the learning of morality and values, and so on and so forth, which guides the rest of the human being, or should guide the rest of the human being, and that's not even visited that often necessarily, but it needs to be there. Just like the Holy of Holies was not visited every day, it was only visited once a year really by the high priest, so too within ourselves, it sometimes takes up the minority of time of how we actually function, but yet it's the most important, if that makes sense. The second part within our personality is the emotions, and that's the second room called the Kodesh, which has three primary vessels, and the three primary vessels represent the three primary emotions that we have, which we've talked about previously, called Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet, right? Which is the Chesed on the right, the kindness, the giving, the flexibility, tolerance, the discipline on the left, and the synthesis of both, the harmony, the Tiferet, which is in the middle. There are six emotions, but the three primary ones are the first three, and that's represented by the three vessels in that part of the Beit HaMikdash. That's within the person. That's why that part of the temple had a roof. However, all of that really is there to inspire the rest of our human experience, which is normally outside of us. It's how we relate to the outside world, how we relate to everything around us, whether it's people, whether it's experiences, whether it's world events, or whatever the case is. And that's the courtyard. And that's where the main function or the main activity of the temple took place. That's why it's in the outside. It's a representative of how we relate to the outside world, but that's supposed to come after the first two. And that becomes the formula of how we supposed to be as a healthy person, where we have the way we think, the way we feel, and then how it inspires how we relate to the outside of us. Now, in order to do this, in order to live like this, the first step that a person has to be able to do is to take control of our mind. Why? This is why this is so difficult. We've talked about this before in different ways, but let's understand in the following context. If the mind needs to rule the heart, or if the mind needs to guide and inspire the heart, the problem with that is, as we've talked about many times, that his feelings, emotions, are a lot stronger and a lot faster than the mind. So when we talk about this concept of the mind guiding the heart, it requires, it needs a strengthening of the mind. It needs us to take control of our mind. What do I mean by that? Because, you know, how often do you hear when people say, I know this is wrong, but I just can't help it. I know I shouldn't have gotten upset, but I did. I know I shouldn't be jealous, but I just am. Right? I know I shouldn't overindulge, but I don't know. It looked too delicious. Right? Whatever. Bad example, maybe, but okay. Right? So what does that mean, I know? So if you know, so then what's the problem? And the answer, of course, is it doesn't look like it, because the way we react to the outside world has nothing to do with how we know. It's how we feel. It's the emotional reaction. It's the response to the outside world. And the response is emotional, and the emotions come in a lot faster and a lot stronger than the brain does. And therefore, even when people say, I know, or I knew, or I understood, or I understand, that I know or that I understand is very weak. It's a weak I know. It's a weak I understand. Right? In other words, what happens is these thoughts that we have when we understand things, they become, you know, our mind wanders, especially nowadays where we wander from one thing to another. Sometimes we feel that our mind is all haphazard, mixed up. Kind of, we have these fleeting, sort of wandering, haphazard type ideas which come and go, right? They come and go in our mind, they come and go in our head. And therefore, because we don't really have control over them, because don't forget, what is intellect? Intellect means understanding something from the outside. It's a concept which is not part of me, which I've absorbed, I've learnt. But until I grab onto it, until I take control of it, it hasn't merged with me, right? It hasn't come to me yet. And therefore, this idea of moach shalet al lev, the brain controlling the heart, doesn't always work, because I might understand the concepts, but I've got control over the concepts. My mind is not in my control. My mind is absorbing ideas, but it's not completely in focus. Right? Where really this is the whole concept of where mindfulness comes in. Now, when we've talked about mindfulness in the past, and if you look in lots of literature about the definition of mindfulness, we've talked a lot about mindfulness being having the ability to focus, right? Having the ability to be in the moment, having the ability to maximize the potential in every moment and in every experience. And that's 100% true. Like letting go of the past, not worrying about the future, but actually absorbing and living and fully maximizing every part of the current experience of the now, right? Now that is certainly part of mindfulness, and that is definitely a big focus of mindfulness. But what we haven't touched upon strongly enough is that mindfulness has a lot more to it than that. And that is that when we talk about mindfulness training, right? Mindfulness training, which means the training and the getting used to focusing, concentrating on the now, or like we've used the expression previously, paying attention on purpose, right? Which comes through a lot of practice, because it's not easy. And it comes through exercises like meditation, and it comes through a lot of different types of exercise and activities to train ourselves how to live in the now and how to focus. But when we learn to do that, right, when we learn to actually pay attention on purpose, we actually also becomes a lot easier to control our responses. Right? Because most of our experiences, I should say, are response-based. Most of what we do is responding to things. Right? Is that fair enough? Yeah? So most of how we act during the day is responding to what's happening to us. Right? And what happens is, very often, sometimes the majority of the time, our responses, whether good or bad, but the responses are very impulsive, they're very quick, they're very rushed, and they're very emotional. They're instinctive, they're sort of impulsive. We just respond the way we respond. Right? And when we do that, our mind doesn't get a chance. Right? So what happens is, we might have the idea, so we've got this, right? We've got the stimulus and the response. Now this comes from Stephen Covey's stuff, where actually originates from Viktor Frankl, where he said between stimulus and response there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response, right? But you have to create that space. Normally we don't. Normally something happens, we impulsively respond. Something upsets us, we get angry. While we're getting angry, then a fleeting thought comes into our mind, hey, this is wrong. And we can't help it anymore because we're on the train already. Right? We've gotten into the argument already. We already said what later we think maybe we shouldn't have said, or whatever the case is, right? So the response comes as a rush. The response comes because there is no time in between, right? There's no time in between the stimulus and the response. There we are. And what happens is, as we've talked about before, the reason there's no space is because emotions are a lot faster. So the emotions take over without having a chance for the mind to think. So creating that space, right, means to take the ideas that we might have, we might understand these ideas, but we need to hold on to them, we need to focus on them so they can change our interpretation of what's happening. As we talked about a number of series ago, our responses to stimulus, the stimulus is not going to change, right? That's an important thing to remember. When someone said to us, they said to us, it's not going to change. When someone cuts us off in the road, it's not, that's what happened. Right? Most of the time, what happened. It's not going to change that. The reason that our responses to stimulus is the way it is because it's how we interpret the experience. Right? So if something happens, we immediately interpret it. Normally, emotionally, we hit back. Then we think, hold on a second, maybe there's a different way to look at this. Right? So we have ideas. There are ideas that are not hard to absorb. There are ideas that are not hard to understand and to process, which could not change what happened, because that won't happen. It could change the interpretation of what happened so that we can reinterpret it and look at it from a different perspective and guide our emotions in a different direction. So I know that's what he said, but maybe that's not what he meant to say. Maybe he didn't mean it in an insulting way. Maybe my plans went all off course today, but maybe there's a reason behind it. Maybe it's for me to do something else. Whatever the case is, whatever the variety of experiences that we have and how we could interpret them, it's sometimes easier, sometimes harder, but we can absorb ideas which could help us reinterpret those experiences. But not when our mind is not in control, because we don't give ourselves, the mind doesn't get much airtime. So therefore, we have to actually slow it down. We have to slow our emotions. We have to create that space. And the way we do that is by learning to be mindful. Mindfulness and mindful exercise and mindful activity actually allows us to be thinking people. Allows us to slow down. Allows us to concentrate on one thing at a time. Allows us to create a pause. Allows us to process every moment properly before we move on to the next moment. It's all part of mindfulness. All part of focusing. When we do that, we train ourselves to be people who can create that pause. We train ourselves to be people who can create that space. When we create that space, then we can have time to think. We can have time to reinterpret. We can have time to be a bit more measured, right? To process each moment separately. To process the experience. To process what actually happened. What was my interpretation? How could interpretation be a bit differently? And then to get our mind fully in control, so that our mind can actually become the guide and inspiration for our emotions. Does that make sense so far? Yeah? Okay. And again, as I said before, this happens through a lot of practice. That's part of what the mindfulness meditation is all about, is to learn to focus, to learn not to take things for granted, to learn to notice the things that we don't notice. It's just to learn to be in control of our mind, not to let our mind just wander from one thing to another and control us, rather for us to be in control of the mind, to choose what we think and to pay attention on purpose. There's a quote I'll read you from a person called Rabbi Arya Kaplan, a very famous author. And he talks about meditation. He says the following. He says, in its most general sense, meditation consists of thinking in a controlled manner. It is deciding exactly how one wishes to direct the mind for a period of time and then doing it. Now, that's not an easy thing to do. That's why it's a good practice, because it teaches us to control our mind. In theory, this may sound very easy, but in practice, it is not. And it's difficult. It's very difficult to pay attention. The human mind is not a domesticated animal, but rather seems to have a mind of its own beyond the will of the thinker. Interesting phrase. Anyone who has ever tried to concentrate on a subject only to have his mind drift to other thoughts is aware of this. Sometimes it seems that the more one tries to control one's thoughts, the more they refuse to be controlled. You ever try to really concentrate on something and it just becomes impossible, right? So it's a real training. He says, one of the first steps in meditation is learning how not to take our thoughts for granted. Okay? That's that concept. Now, let's take it a step further. The first step is what we just spoke about. We have to have our control of our mind to think, to create that space, to be able to interpret experiences so that we can respond to stimulus in a different way. However, there's something called the stuck mind. That's my phrase. But very real, I think. What I mean by stuck mind, I just saw this play out a couple days ago where someone came to see me who had had a very challenging experience, which is taken place a while ago, and was having a very, very difficult time bouncing back. So we talked for a long time. We're going to continue to talk. And it was obvious that time wasn't working. And obviously, I never tried to explain challenge. We spoke about this many, many times. I don't know why this challenge is. I don't know the reason for things. Only God knows. But we talked about thought patterns that could help the person come back. The person's an intelligent human being. Understood them. But then what came out was as follows. It just kept going around in circles. Every time I thought, sorry, we were making a bit of progress, the person said, but. It's that but. And then just came back with the same pattern of thinking that they were used to all the time. But isn't it true, so and so and so? Obviously, I'm hiding the details because I don't want to talk about the details. But so it was that big but. But it could have been avoided. But this, but that. No matter how long we talked about alternatives, alternative explanation, alternative interpretations, it kept coming back to but, and the person just couldn't get past it. Hopefully they will eventually, but they couldn't get past it. Why? Because even when we do give the mind a chance, even when we do spend time focusing, even when we create a bit of a decision that we are going to try and reinterpret and to create thought patterns that will help the person emerge from that difficulty. The power of the mind is only so limited. And if the mind is stuck, which it often is, and the thinking pattern of the person is stuck in a particular perspective, no matter how much time they give their mind, it just won't work. Because that's mind is very stuck. So what has to happen in such a case is, now again, what I'm about to say, I want to make this very clear. What I'm about to say is not a substitute for what we just explained. What we just explained is the foundation. We can't get past base one unless we learn to focus and to give our mind time to think. However, step two is, we have to take the mindful process and to do something even greater than just think, and that is use the tool of the mind to access the subconscious. Use the conscious to access the subconscious. As Rabbi Arya Kaplan himself says, one of the most powerful benefits of meditation is control over the unconscious mind. Now, let's explain this. Let's explore this. You'll see where I'm going towards the end. You see, the conscious mind, not everyone understands this, but the conscious mind is not the first point of entry for the human experience. But we know that the conscious mind is very influenced and very inspired sometimes, and often very guided by remote control unknowingly by that which is unconscious or subconscious. Okay. Because as we know, we've talked about this many times, that the five levels of the soul and so on and so forth, but the different layers of the soul that we have is divided into two. We have the conscious layers of who we are, the conscious layers of the soul, of which the highest layer is intellect, the mind, the tool to think, right? But we also have the subconscious, that's what we're not aware of, which is the irrational, supra-rational part of the human being, which is, although not in our consciousness, but it's much more powerful, it's much more infinite, it's much deeper than the conscious mind. Because that part of our unconscious mind has the power, if we can access it, that's the problem, accessing it is the problem, to mold, to change us, to transform, to really reshape the conscious mind. And when the conscious mind is stuck, we need to understand that the power of focusing can also tap into the unconscious and let the power from the unconscious, the subconscious part of our mind, come and reshape and transform and support the conscious experience. It can unstick the mind if we do it properly. But how do we do that? So we do it through an amazing tool. Because how do you access the unconscious? You can only do it through the conscious. Us human beings only operate in the conscious. When we're conscious, we're conscious. We're only conscious of our consciousness, right? So how do we use the conscious part of who we are to access the unconscious? So the very first part of our conscious mind is a door into the unconscious, and it's called the first one of the conscious thinking patterns, the idea of Chochmah. Right? Remember, going back to the ten levels, right? So we've got three tools of the mind: Chochmah, Bina, and Da'at. We've talked about this before. Bina is really where we understand things. Most of the time when we learn, when we understand, what we're actually using is Bina. I don't mean the building, I mean the power of the mind. That too, but that's why we called it Bina, actually. One of the reasons. Apart from the fact that it was easy to say. Right? So Bina means a building. Bina means where you understand things. You take an idea, you develop it, you explore it, you analyze it, you process it, you fully understand it, you review it, you come back, and so on and so forth. But there are three components of intellect. And the first one is called Chochmah. And Chochmah means conception. Okay? And Chochmah means, this is the power of Chochmah. Let me explain the tool of Chochmah. Chochmah is what God gave us. It's a little bit deep, this. I'm going to try and make it as clear as I can. The mystics tell us that the Hebrew word for Chochmah is koach, which means it's a power, it's a conscious power. It's taken from two words. If you take the words Chochmah, I should have put it up there, but I didn't. It's koach, meaning it's a power, it's a part of our consciousness. But ma, what is it? It's like it's just it seems to be intangible. It seems to be something hard to grasp. Because as I've explained previously, what Chochmah is actually, it's a flash, it's a new flash. It's a conception of a new idea. It's something completely new that we allow to enter, we give permission, so to speak, to enter our mind. In other words, what Chochmah is, it allows us, it's that transition, it's that connection between the conscious and the unconscious. That's what Chochmah is. Chochmah is the willingness in our conscious mind to stop being stuck and to open the door for something beyond our consciousness, beyond our normal consciousness. Something more powerful, something fresh, something new. Am I making sense? So, yeah, we're okay? Let me read you a paragraph from Rabbi Wolf's book, because this part of Chochmah I'm taking from him. I mean, it's talked about a lot in mystical teachings in general, but he puts it very nicely. He says the following. Kabbalists call this power of Chochmah Mochas Tumo, which means the hidden brain. It is the metaphor for the subconscious state. Hasidic rabbis rearranged the Hebrew letters of the word Chochmah to read Koach Ma, which means this potential. It's not actual something, it's potential of something. Ma, what is it? It represents the basic elements of our... Oh, I actually put this up. Right? And he says, Chochmah allows us to draw away from the subconscious, and it is also the substance of our thoughts and feelings. Draw from the subconscious. So it's the doorway, it's the pathway to bring something from the subconscious into our conscious. Now, to do this, how do we do this? How do we use Chochmah? Okay. First of all, it needs, as we said before, a very strong focus. It needs a real clear, objective mind to be open to something new. It needs an element of surrender. See, this is where the mystics struggle with this Chochmah power. It's Chochmah tool. Normally, when you understand something, it's the opposite of surrendering. You get that? When I understand, if I read a book, a complex idea, and I want to understand it, the I is there. I want to understand it. Right? But before I do that, if it's something completely beyond me, I've got to use the intellectual brain, which is normally quite self-centered, because it's a lot of I, it's I understand, to open up my mind to something beyond me. It takes a certain amount of surrender. That's why the mystics say that emunah, faith, lives in Chochmah. Even though emunah is not rational necessarily. But it comes through Chochmah, because it's my willingness to surrender to something beyond me. Right? We have to have the belief and the resolve that we can do that. We have to believe in the subconscious. We have to believe in the depth of our soul. We have to believe that there's something far greater, far more powerful, far beyond the conscious mind. Now, here's the danger when we do this. There are two things that live in the subconscious. Okay, just to take it even a step further. There are two things that live in the subconscious. The depth of our ego lives there. So accessing the subconscious is not always a good idea. The strength of our ego. Just read Freud, you'll understand it. Right? At the very essence of who we are, beyond our consciousness, there's certainly a very strong sense of ego. But also in our subconscious lives the very, very deep and powerful divine consciousness and divine spark. Let's put that in different terminology, which you used to or you've heard before. Oops. No. What we call the animal soul and the godly soul. Right? This is what complicates the human experience so much, as we've talked about many times. That we're not one person. We have two conflicting forces. And these conflicting forces are very deep. These conflicting forces go very, very down to the root of our subconscious. Not just our conscious. They operate on the conscious levels too. But we have an animalistic drive, which by definition is animalistic, and that's always a symbol for egocentricity in Kabbalistic teachings. It's very impulsive, it's very me. Which is why I've said many, many times that when you hear people say, I've got to trust my inner self, that's not always true. And it's not always so successful, it's not always so effective. Because which inner self are you talking about? Right? That needs to be tested. What do you mean you're trusting it? Yeah.
Can the animal soul and the godly soul change? Can we intrinsically change our intrinsic nature?
No, you can transform, you can get your animal on side. Meaning that the mission of the human being is to bring mastery to the godly soul over the animal soul. Because you see, the animal soul, it's a good question, let me just pick up on that for a moment. The animal soul has a function. See, the animal soul is very important. It plays a very important role. But it needs to be tamed, it needs to be worked with. Why? Because the animal soul has something the godly soul doesn't have. Let me just explain this. Actually, I'm happy you brought that up. Let me just go there for a minute. The reason that God gave us both is for a reason. Because the animal soul has something else besides ego. Its ego manifests itself in incredible emotion, incredible passion. You see, both souls have both intellect and emotion, right? But the primary force in the animal soul is emotion. The primary source in the godly soul is insight, understanding God, right? More intellectual. That's just the nature of the two souls. Now, emotion is very, very important. Even talking about the way the sources, the Jewish sources, talk about serving God. There's nothing more than serving God with joy, love, passion, excitement, enthusiasm, right? Emotion is very, very important. Our life experience happens in emotion. And therefore, there's a certain energy in the animal soul we are taught that if we harness it properly, can be extremely powerful as long as we remove the ego. And that's hard, right? But in its raw state, see, the godly soul is the guide. The godly soul is the ideas, the concepts, the values, the morality, right? The divine spark. So number one, we can change to a point. First of all, we can't change our intrinsic spark. That we can't change. We all have that intrinsic spark. We all have that intrinsic godly spark, which, by the way, although they both live in the subconscious, but the intrinsic spark is deeper than the ego. That's the part Freud didn't get, right? He didn't get the divine spark behind the ego. Deeper than the ego. That's why if we access it, it's more powerful than the ego. But we have to access it, right? So the animal soul is what we could change, and we could channel, I should say. We could elevate, we could refine, we could control. But it's there for a purpose, because if we harness it, the idea is not to destroy the animal soul, by the way. First of all, the animal soul makes us function physically. We eat, we sleep, we relate to others all through the animal soul. But also, the animal soul needs to be channeled. And I've said this before, like in terms of parenting and guiding others. Sometimes when you find people with bad personalities, we try to crush them. And that's sometimes very often a mistake. It doesn't need to be crushed. It needs to be channeled. Sometimes the raw material is good. It's coming manifest itself in the ways of the animal soul. And therefore, it's not doing well. It's not expressing itself in a healthy way. But it can be, right? I was in Melbourne the other day and did there's a school down there, and I did some work with teachers all day on bringing out the best in every child and differentiation and so on and so forth. And we talked, part of the day, we talked a lot about this, that every child has a strength. The problem is that schools are only made for half the population, and the other half don't fit into schools, which is another discussion, because just different types of personalities. But sometimes if a good teacher, a good educator, can try to channel some of those out-of-the-box personalities into a really positive context, and they can fly, they can soar, but needs to be channeled. Not crushed, but channeled. And that's very, very different, right? By the way, just on that topic, if you look at the prayers, the morning prayers, both in the weekdays and on Shabbat, there's a section before the Shema where we talk a lot about angels. I don't know if you ever noticed that. We talk about angels, a lot about angels. How the angels praise God and sing to God and so on and so forth. And if you look closely, you'll see that we refer to angels as Chayot HaKodesh, holy animals. Angels are called animals. Why? Because we are taught that angels are called animals because angels are emotional beings. That's what they are. That's the definition of an angel. An angel is a being that God created. I don't know exactly what an angel looks like or feels like, but an angel is a being that serves God with feeling. So you have the group of angels led by the angel called Michael, actually, which serve God out of love. You have the angels led by Gabriel that serves God out of fear, out of more awe. Right? Different types of angels. That's why they're called animals, because animals are emotional beings. The difference between animals down here and angels are holy animals. In other words, their emotions are channeled in a very holy context. But just like animals that they cannot really change on their own, they are what they are, so too angels cannot change. The reason that the human being could change is because of the godly souls, because we have the spark of godliness which could guide and mold the animal, right? It's a different type of soul. And so that's why we talk about angels, because angels are animals like an animal soul, but it's a lesson for us that even an animal soul could be channeled to be holy, just like the holy animals. Okay. So let's go back to this a second. So we're talking about now using the tool of Chochmah. Chochmah means to open ourselves up to new ideas, to ideas, forceful ideas, powerful ideas that will change our thinking, that will unstick our mind coming from the subconscious. But here we have to be careful. Because when we delve into the subconscious, when we open to the subconscious, we have to make sure that we're not digging deeper into our ego, but rather we're connecting with true values, true thoughts, thoughts that are godly, thoughts that are going to not be egocentric, but rather selfless, to be able to unstick ourselves and to be able to channel ourselves and to improve ourselves and to be better human beings. Right? What's the gauge for that? The gauge for that is, again, this concept of chokhmah, as I said. Because what chokhmah is, that tool of chokhmah, which is the first one of the 10 powers of the soul, it's the window into the subconscious, it's the first way of thinking. The real way to utilize the concept of chokhmah is that concept of selflessness, surrender. To say, this is not working the way I am now, I need to actually surrender to something higher than myself. Something other than myself. If I go into my subconscious and just connect to my intrinsic impulses, to what some people refer to as my inner self, I'm just going deeper into myself. And therefore the outcome could just be the same egocentric and I'll just be as stuck as I was before. But what Judaism teaches us when it talks about these concepts is that we have to be ready to lift ourselves and to connect to something, a new idea that's living in our subconscious mind that isn't us. But it's that godly spark that is in us, but it's from higher than us. It's coming from beyond us. So that we can entertain a thought that is different to us, that is different to what I'm used to, that is a different perspective, that is a different way of looking at it, that is just a whole new way of perhaps interpreting the experiences and the stimulus around us. So let's go back and see how this, just go back to that model I started with. Right. We talk about the head, the heart, and the outside, right? Which is behavior. So what that room that's representative of the head, is, why was it representative of the head? Because it had the aron, which is learning, understanding. So it's the mind, then the three emotions, and then the outside activity. But if you go back to that room that had the aron, that had the ark, it wasn't just the ark that it had. It had the divine presence. It had the cherubs, which were on top of the ark, which represented and manifested the presence of God. Something higher than the understanding, something higher than the mind. The ark itself with the Torah that was in the ark represented the learning, the mind, but the cherubs on top of the ark represented the divine presence. Using the mind is what we need to do, especially when we use the chokhmah, to tune into something new, to tune into a whole new way of thinking, to tune into the subconscious part of who we are so we can get fresh, powerful, pure, transformative ideas so we can unstick ourselves. But it needs to be a real chokhmah. Chokhmah means that it's, although it's understanding, but it's surrendering ourselves to something higher than our understanding, than our own understanding, to a higher code. In Judaism, that's the idea of the Torah, the moral code that is not us. It's God's set of values, God's set of morals that He gives us to be able to tap into so that we can rethink and reinterpret, so we can reshape our moral compass and reshape our whole moral thinking so that it becomes a whole different way of thinking, a whole different way of experiencing. So that's also represented by this whole sort of formula. And that's why that Holy of Holies, that room, traditionally was a room of miracles, was a place where miracles took place. There were many, many miracles that took place in that room. Because it represents also the miracle of the human being. The miracle of changing, the miracle of thinking differently. Most things are stuck in the world. Most creations are the way they are. The miracle of the human being is that we can change. We can transform. We just have to do it. We have to sometimes not just focus, but focus in a way where we can access something deep and more powerful, but only in the true way where we access not the subconscious ego, but the subconscious higher spark that we have. And that spark comes with a determination, it comes with belief, it comes with faith, it comes with strength, it comes with a sense of values and morality, and it comes with a whole set of powerful tools that allows us to sort of make that change. There are so many stories of how this plays out, but getting back to the time of the year that we're in, the time of the 3 weeks, this is what happened to the Jewish people collectively. We are still here today. Even though we commemorate what happened during the 3 weeks and all the unbelievable, untold trouble that happened during the time of the 3 weeks, which is the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and the following exiles, particularly the Roman exile, the persecution, and the things that happened, and what happened during that time. Let me let you into a little secret. One of the amazing sources that we use, and we've used it here all the time, and it's used in Jewish law, and it's used in all forms of Jewish learning and thinking, is the Talmud. Right? Talmud is this conglomeration, this repository of endless Jewish learning, Jewish law, Jewish analysis, Jewish ethics, Jewish morals, everything. It's when was the Talmud developed? When was this amazing piece of academic work, rich work, developed? In the most difficult times of Jewish history. Most difficult times of Jewish history. Rabbi Akiva, one of the foremost leading Talmudists in the Talmud, right? He didn't have a peaceful day in his life. He was pursued and persecuted by the Romans constantly, under threat of death. Together with his colleagues, together with that generation, they went from place to place. The academies of learning had to keep relocating. Why? Because there's this resolve in the Jewish nation. No, yes, trouble, but we're going to come back. We're going to unstick. We're going to just dig deeper. We're going to find that spark in the unconsciousness that will just reshape everything that we do. And what happens? What emerges? Something even stronger, something even more powerful, something amazing. The Talmud was written in times. And it's throughout history we have it. Post-Holocaust, we find many, many stories of individuals. I think I've told this many times. I always think, when I think of this, I always think of one of the people who I always am fascinated about, someone called the Kloisenberger Rebbe. I've told you about this before, I'm sure. No. Kloisenberger, no, never. Kloisenberger was an amazing Hasidic Rebbe. He was a great Hasidic Rebbe before the war. He lost a wife and 10 children in the Holocaust. Right? Now, if you ever go to Israel today, there's a religious hospital in Netanya called the Leonardo Hospital. Very, very advanced, very, very high-functioning hospital. It was built by him. Why? He came out of the Holocaust. The first Shabbos that he was in the DP camps, he sat down and made that resolve that he was going to take revenge, and his revenge was going to be to rebuild. I don't know where he got it from. He had every reason in the rational mind to give up. Every reason just to say, I'm done. Very nice. It was a good try. I'm done. I'll just live a quiet life somewhere. I'll just coast through. And then he said, no. He dug deeper. He had that coming from the, it comes from the unconscious mind. It wasn't from the rational mind. The rational mind didn't make any sense. There were no answers. There were just questions. And yet he started right away. And he rebuilt. And one of the things, he built yeshivot, he built communities. One of the things he had promised himself during the war, he was going to build a hospital to help people. And it's the most amazing hospital. In fact, it's one of the most beautiful stories that around the hospital is that he eventually established two communities. One in Israel, he loved Israel. And one in America, we had arrived in Union City, New Jersey. So he ended up having two communities, which he built, and eventually he moved to Israel full time. But when the hospital was finally ready, and the first child was born in the hospital, he was overseas. So they called him, and they put the phone next to the crying baby, and he said, "That's my revenge. That's it." Right. So anyway, a most amazing person, but there's so many stories like that. There are many, many, many stories of not such great individuals. But this is not only about tremendous, tremendous, it's about even the regular day. When we wake up in the morning and things go wrong, or wake up or someone says something to us, or someone looks at us wrong. It doesn't have to be monumental, it doesn't have to be persecution, it doesn't have to be a tremendous challenge. Those are more difficult, those require amazing strength. But we need this concept every day. We need this chokhmah every day. We need, first of all, as we said in the beginning, we need our mind to focus, first of all, so we can create that pause. We need that mindfulness training so that we can learn to think, learn to take it easy, learn to be measured, learn to take every moment in focus so we can interpret everything that we do. In some literature, it's called mitinut, calmness. In other words, just approach everything. Don't jump. Just think it through. And when the thinking it through becomes more difficult, then we need to employ the tool of chokhmah. Just, if it's too difficult, let's open ourselves up. Let's surrender to something higher. Maybe there's something in the unconscious or the subconscious that could reinvent the interpretation a little bit better. And when we do that, we learn to create that pause, we learn to use the mind, and then the mind can have a better control over the heart. In the coming weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to try and look at some of the other tools and see how that mindfulness concept helps us use the other tools of the soul to make us a better and more healthy human being. Have a wonderful day and a wonderful week.